nice to have you back, Ray.
Thanks, Nima.
And let's get started with the latest news on what has happened in the West Bank. An American activist, and she was killed in the West Bank by the IDF. And what's your understanding of what has happened?
Well, it was an Israeli sharpshooter, a sniper, that killed this young Turkish origin American citizen woman who just recently graduated from the University of Washington. What was she doing? She was with a group called the International Solidarity Group, okay? And what they do is they accompany Palestinians while they try to stand before their homes before they're demolished, hoping to prevent the demolishment of the homes. They accompany the children to school. They try to witness, so that there are outside witnesses from the international scene to see what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians. In this case, there's a little village in the West Bank that the settlers were taking over parts of, and there have been weekly demonstrations of the villagers saying, no, we don't want that. This one had some violence to it, but the violence subsided, and then after a few minutes, there were two sniper shots, one of which caught this young woman from the University of Washington right in the back of the head. This is she. Now, that's her graduation photo. You'll see she has a keffiyeh on. She made no bones about the fact that she supported the Palestinian cause. And that's, of course, why she put herself in danger and joined the solidarity movement there over in the West Bank. This is not the first time this happened, of course. July 2 years ago, Shireen Hakleh, an American citizen, Palestinian also, a photographer, was also shot by a sharpshooter. That time it went through the front of her head. The story is important because it shows that the United States will support Israel no matter what. Okay, this all happened Friday after the last session that you and I had. So over the weekend they had a chance to think this through. There were reports in the press as to what happened, and the State Department spokesman on Monday, so that would have been the 9th, okay, he says, well, it's not clear what happened there. We don't know with full certainty. We're waiting for the findings of the Israeli investigation, okay? Yeah. He declined to acknowledge that Eiji, that's her name, was killed by an Israeli soldier, and he called for, you know, let the process play out and let the facts be gathered. Now, the problem was there was a reporter from Haaretz, Israeli newspaper of long standing, right next to her when she was shot. Okay. So here's the State Department. After 3 days, they were not at all clear, you know, I'm good. Let the Israelis investigate. Okay, so that's Monday. Now what's Tuesday? Tuesday they catch President Biden in a little press thing at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Where are you going? I'm going to my grandma, my granddaughter's birthday party. Well, what about the young woman who was killed in the West Bank? And he says, well, quote, apparently it was an accident. Apparently it ricocheted off the ground and just hit her in the head by accident. I'm working on it now. Huh. Okay. So he's working on that. Who got to him to tell him it was a ricochet? Wow. Sort of like a bank shot in basketball off the backboard, a ricochet hit her right in the back of the head. Wow. Somebody got to him and said, this Israeli say it might be a ricochet. So that's what the president says. Now, pay particular attention to his last words here. I'm working on it now. Okay. Next question. What about leaving or releasing restrictions on the use of long-range weapons in Ukraine. Biden, we're working on that right now. I cite that because if you can believe, if you wish, that Biden is working on things right now, but it doesn't seem he's really fully in control. Other people are telling him things. Witness the fact that yesterday, so we have Monday, Tuesday. Yesterday was Wednesday, right? Okay. Yesterday, he condemns, Biden does, as totally unacceptable, the death of the American activists. And they're going to look into it now. But the Israelis are doing the investigation. There's a good example. What's that, CNN? Yeah, good example. And that's what this young woman looks like. She's 26, and she follows a sad line of American citizens that have been killed deliberately by Israeli sharpshooters. So what's going to happen? Well, the Israelis are going to investigate. Last time they did that, well, they haven't really investigated in a long time, but when Rachel Corrie was killed, I think that's worth bringing to mind here, because that was the most atrocious of all. Rachel Corrie was in this same group, the International Solidarity Movement, okay? Young people who accompany Palestinians and try to prevent harm coming to them. Rachel was working in Rafah, okay? Rafah, you know what that is, southern Gaza. And she was staying in the home of two Palestinians. One was a doctor, okay? She was staying in there, and they got word early in the morning, as usually happens, oh, the bulldozers are going to come and demolish our home. Oh, my God. So what did Rachel do? She went out, and she stood in front of the bulldozer. Said, stop, okay? Now, we know that the bulldozer got instructions not only to run her over, but to back over her to make sure that her back was broken. There are photos of that. I won't show them right now. There are photos of that happening and of her young friends ministering to her. She was dead on arrival when she got to the hospital, okay? So what am I saying here? Well, I'm saying that the Israelis were dead set and determined to show that not even international volunteers were safe from this kind of treatment. And important fact, Israelis knew quite well that on the 16th of March, which was the date that bulldozer ran over Rachel and backed over her, that was 3 days before, 4 days before shock and awe in Iraq, the UK-US invasion of Iraq. Would Rachel's death, or Rachel's murder, be carried in the newspapers? Forget about it. We had shock and awe to look at. We had those Iraqis who were charged with having nuclear weapons that we're going to do them in. So the Israelis are very cynical about this. They made sure that they did that on a date that everyone in the international community would know. That's it. Up until then, they didn't kill international volunteers, just ones from Israel proper or from some other part of occupied is the West Bank. But this time they want to make it clear, no, that's it. We're going to do American citizens as well. Now, last thing I'll say on that, I feel, as you probably gather, I feel a little strongly about this, because it was 2 years after this happened that I met Craig and Cindy Corrie, Rachel's parents. That was arranged. We had a 3-hour brunch, okay? And I was wearing an orange little plastic armband, and Craig, Rachel's father, says, Ray, what's that? I said, well, I'm in a movement against torture. We identify ourselves with those orange uniforms and Gitmo and so forth. So I said, what's that, Craig? He had a green armband on. I said, oh, well, here, let me show you. So he took it off. Whoops, that one broke. He took it off, and he said, and what it said was, Rachel Corrie, March 16, 2023. and that had her birthday as well. She was 23. Okay, so he saw how that struck me. He said, "Would you like it?" And I said, "Well, do you have others?" "Yeah, we have several others." I said, "So I've been wearing that. This one just broke. This is about the sixth one that broke. They're not very sturdy. They're cheap, right? But I have others that have been sent to me by Greg Corey." So the bottom line is, I feel that people who do this kind of witness, who put their bodies behind what they say, usually young people, but by far, not all of them are young people, that they are a sort of witness to me. And so when I'm feeling like it's closing in on me, or maybe somebody will arrive to search my house and my car or something like that, I just look at that little armband and I say, "Well, you know, if Rachel Curry can stand in front of an Israeli bulldozer simply to try to protect the house of some Palestinians she knows from being demolished, well, you can face into whatever's coming for you, McGovern." And I, you know, I'm a Catholic, and we have these things called sacramentals, not quite sacraments, but little things that remind you that they bring you the grace of resistance. Okay, so when I look at that, it's a sacramental to me, saying, "Look, you know, this is designed to remind me that courage was displayed by this young 23-year-old woman, whose parents I'm very good friends with now. You could do whatever you're called to do, McGovern." Last thing, of course, is that the Corys pursued every legal avenue that they could have to get a justice done. They knew who the bulldozer driver was, and there was a kind of a kangaroo court in opposite kangaroo court. He was exonerated. They never got to first base, and no one from the American administration, Bush at the time, lifted a finger to help her, with one exception, and that was Larry Wilkerson, who was chief of staff to Colin Powell at that time. He did the right thing. He corresponded with the Corey family, encouraged them to pursue it, although gave them reality checks on how painful and how unsuccessful that was likely to be. So Larry did that, no one else. And so how are we going to look at this new Israeli investigation? Well, you know, it looks like a ricochet to me. Give me a break.
Yeah. Ray, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, we've learned that Anthony Blinken and his the Secretary of Foreign Affairs of the United Kingdom together went to Ukraine. In your opinion right now, are they seeking some sort of escalations, or they're trying to bring some sort of sanity to the administration in Ukraine?
I smile at the word sanity. There isn't any sanity on the part of Tony Blinken, and that's a real serious problem. What we have here is he and the Foreign Secretary of Britain were telling Zelensky yesterday, I'm convinced that they were telling him, "Look, we're going to get longer range missilery, longer range artillery, and we're going to hit well inside Russia. That'll show them. And you won't lose this war, at least not now." Okay. We hope that this will divert attention from what's going on in the Donbas, where the Russians are moving twice as fast as they were before. We'll show them. Okay. What's the whole deal here, Nima? The whole deal is the U.S. election on the 5th of November. Okay. We have to feel, that is the administration, the president and the vice president, who is running for president now, has to be, what's the word she used? Lethal. Okay. Yeah. It's almost as though she was saying, look, no matter what gender I am, I can be lethal as the rest of them, right? Okay, so they're going to be lethal, okay? Now, what's going to be the effect of this? They will be able to, if they're able to shoot these things, if the Russians don't destroy them first, which is altogether likely in the majority of cases, they will make some clever shots inside, far inside Russia, maybe even Moscow. Moscow is hit by drones already, long-range drones from Ukraine. What is Putin going to do? Now, there is a lot of conflation of statements by Putin and Lavrov, the foreign minister, about nuclear weapons. We're talking about what the Russians call non-strategic nuclear weapons, which means mini nukes, small nuclear weapons, not even as big as the ones against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, maybe half the size or just a little. I mean, these things are nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are nuclear weapons, okay? Now, the Russians have been alluding to that for the first time ever, and I've been watching this a long time. We have small range nuclear weapons, okay? We have exercised them. We have exercised them with Belarus, which has on its territory nuclear warheads. So we're ready to use these things. Now, why would the Russians use these things? I don't know. When you're winning, you don't resort to these kinds of measures, do you? The Russians are winning. Now, that doesn't say that I'm rooting for the Russians or that I'm in Putin's pocket, for God's sake. That just says that the head of the CIA was not correct when he advised the president in July of last year. Putin has already lost the Russian military has been exposed for the derelict military that it is to the whole world. And as you know, Biden repeated that 6 days later. I think it was the 13th of July last year. I think he was in Helsinki at the time. So it's a little bit embarrassing now. It doesn't look like the Russians have lost. It doesn't look like Bill Burns is head of the CIA, nominal boss, Avril Haines, the national director of national intelligence, doesn't like look like she was right, saying in December of 2022, Russians are running out of ammunition. They don't have indigenous capability to replace the weaponry that they're losing in the battlefield. Doesn't seem that she was right either. So why would anyone believe these guys now? Well, the answer, of course, is in the press. Nobody remembers what they said in July of last year. So this is really, it kind of gets to the point where people can believe that the Russians are threatening to use nuclear weapons. What they're trying to do, in my view, and I've been watching Russian leaders for a half century, if you will, they're trying to say, look, don't even think, NATO, US, of using nuclear weapons, because we got them too. We've even exercised them. We have them on the front line, not only with us, but with Belarus. Don't even think about it. Now, why do the Russians think they have to do this kind of warning to preempt or to deter? Well, because one side is losing in this war, and that's NATO, US, Ukraine. Losing definitively, despite what Bill Burns, head of CIA, and the president himself said in July of last year, they're losing, okay? And this fool's errand where, with NATO support, Ukrainian forces decided to invade Russia proper in Kursk, about a month ago, okay? That was really crazy. Very, very staunch supporters of Ukraine are saying that was crazy, insane, because why? Well, they were the best troops that Ukraine had left. They were the sort of the reserves, and they're in there. And you know, they made a terrific showing and changed the narrative. That's what seems to be important in the West. They changed the narrative, okay, but they're all going to get killed. There are about 8,000 already killed there, and they have no real way of escape. So the ones that went to Kursk have been sacrificed. And where were they needed? They were needed on the front line in Donbas. And the Russians, according to everyone, not only Vladimir Putin, the Russians are going twice as fast toward the Dnieper River in the Donbas. So what I'm saying here is this. Why would Russia want to use a nuclear weapon? Well, it doesn't have to. I go back and I cite John F. Kennedy, president, when I came into the CIA. He said in a very moving speech on June 10th, 1963, look, can't we just live together? Our children, we look forward to the good future for all our children. And besides, the one thing we learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis, which happened not half a year before he made this speech, okay? The one thing we learned is that when you have two nuclear powers, you have to avoid any situation where one is faced with a choice of humiliating defeat or using those weapons. Now, is one side in the Ukraine fracas? Are they faced with a humiliating defeat? Well, I dare say NATO, the US, and Ukraine are precisely that. It's up to Putin how fast he wants to move to take over that part of Ukraine east of the Dnieper River, okay? And so I think that these warnings that the Russians have made with respect to possible use of nuclear weapons are directed at NATO and those folks who might be asked by the US one fine day, look, it's only a month before the election of November 5. It looks like the Russians are going to definitively win and thumb their noses at us. How about just one little mini nuke? One little thing. We'll show them business. You know, we'll show them that we're really tough. We'll be, in Kamala Harris's word, lethal. What could be more lethal than that? So that's how I interpret all that. I don't think that I don't think Putin is going to be naive or stupid enough to rise to the bait where the U.S. wants Russia to do something really, really bad to justify a U.S. or NATO reaction, okay? Putin is biding his time. He has already said a month ago, look, we don't expect anything to happen before the U.S. election. I think that's the case. I think he's very prudent, and since he doesn't have to do anything, these new strikes that would be enabled by long-range missiles, well, pinpricks, pinpricks. Nobody thinks there'd be nuclear weapons, but if they are mounted on planes like the F-16, or if some really nuclear-capable artillery or missilery is brought into Ukraine, well, then you have a real possibility that the Russians will react in a really strong way. I still think short of nuclear weapons, but they have all kinds of hypersonic missiles against which we have no defense. NATO has no defense. And even the Patriot missiles have shown themselves not really effective against less than hypersonic missiles. So that's how I look at Ukraine right now. I don't expect any big things until after the election. And why not? If I were Putin, I'd say, well, you know, Trump is unpredictable. That's why we don't like him. I mean, it's completely understandable, isn't it? He's unpredictable. And Putin said that about 3 months ago. More recently, he's trolling, I think, Kamala. He said, we support Kamala Harris. Yeah, I think the Russians just have to be on tenterhooks, okay? And they are. That means that they're on alert lest somebody do something really strange, and they can react quickly. Hopefully no one will do that before the election, and then they'll have to see whether Trump has some sort of plan or whether he's more sensible, or, you know, whether he's serious and whether he'd make it stick. All that is very much up in the air, but why do something now? I know some of my colleagues have said, you know, that there's even a chance that they would use them against Washington or against New York. I don't think it's that bad yet. I think it's more a case of warning, of preemption, deterrence in the real sense of the word, making sure that NATO and the U.S. doesn't resort to the kinds of things that the Russians have. By the way, they have many more tactical nukes and many different kinds of nukes than we do in the theater in Europe.
Ria Novosti reported that Pentagon intends to study the impact of nuclear weapons on the agricultural sector of Eastern European countries and Russia. And do you think that in their mind, they're really thinking of risking a nuclear war against Russia? Because that would be hugely influential for the Europe and the way that they are right now, their economy, the situation in Europe is totally unbelievable. And right now with this new report that Pentagon is studying that case, how serious is that for Russians, in your opinion?
Well, the Russians, of course, Ria Novosti, they read the same reports that we read. I don't know how seriously they take this sort of thing. But, you know, it's not just Putin that makes these decisions, or Foreign Minister Lavrov. It's the Russian military, okay? Now, picture Putin sitting in his desk here. When he makes decisions like that, at least figuratively speaking, he has generals and admirals galore looking over his shoulders and saying, Vladimir Vladimirovich, this is really important. We military, we do intelligence, okay? We don't look at enemy intentions. We look at enemy capabilities. And they have the capability to do this. They had all kinds of biolabs spread throughout Ukraine and other parts of the world. What were they doing with those biolabs? So they're experimenting on these things. And the thing that we worry about, Mr. President Putin, is that nobody's in charge there in Russia, in Washington. Biden always says, well, we're working on that. Well, who's working on that? Biden? No, he's not working on it. It's Blinken and Sullivan and, to a degree, Austin. So they're working on that, but they have a big, big stake in this thing because they don't want to lose the election, because then they would lose their freedom. I mean, Trump has the book on these guys, and I've said that many times. They have a personal stake in this, just as Netanyahu has a personal stake in not being driven out of office, because he too would end up in jail. Sometimes history shows that personal stakes like this have a hell of a lot to do with the prolongation of wars and worse. So, I'd leave it at that.
Before this visit of Antony Blinken together, and with I forgot his name, the Secretary of Foreign Affairs of the United Kingdom. His name is, if I'm not,
it's Lammy.
Lammy, yeah, it's David Lammy. Yeah, before this visit, we had a meeting between CIA and MI6, a public meeting after decades. Behind the scene, they're having meetings, a lot of meetings, but right now a public meeting. It seems to me that they're trying to send an official message to Russia or maybe to China. What would that mean, Ray, in your opinion?
Well, you know, I would say that there's an advantage for being an old guy, okay? Because I remember back in 2002, one of the last times that the head of the CIA and the head of British intelligence, MI6, his name was Sir Richard dear love, when they got together on the 20th of July, 2002, as the administration was getting ready for war with Iraq, with the full participation of Tony Blair, who had met with George W. Bush personally, had agreed to UK forces would certainly come into this. And so now that was, that was summer, that was spring of 2002. For those who forget, the invasion was March 20th or so, 2003. So they had to figure out how to orchestrate this. Okay. Meanwhile, they kept sending troops, of course, into the area. So Tony Blair would talk to George W. Bush once a week or so, but it ain't the same as meeting in person. Okay. And so he's his big stake in this, right? So he's wondering, is Bush really going to attack Iraq, and should I really support him in this? So I know George Tenet, the head of the CIA, is like this with George W. Bush. He knows his every thought virtually. Sir Richard Dearlove, head of MI6, why don't you please go to talk with George Tenet and see what's really going on? And Dearlove says, yes, sir, of course I will. And then he calls Tenet, now, too busy. The White House says, no, Sir Richard Dearlove, you meet with him, okay? So it was on a Saturday, the 20th of July, 2002. I had a friend who was there. What happens? Well, George Tenet says, well, look, just between you and me, the president decided to do a war against Iraq, and we're going to say he has weapons of mass destruction, and that he might not only use them, but he might give them to terrorists. And besides, we're going to conflate 9/11. We're going to say things that suggest to the American people that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. That'll get them all stirred up and supportive, So that's what's going to happen. It's going to happen pretty soon. So, go tell Tony Blair. It's real. Be confident. We're going ahead with this, okay? Now, that was the 20th of July, 2002. Now, we go 3 days later, January 23rd, 2002, and there's a big meeting. Sort of a cabinet-type meeting, but just national security officials in at 10 Downing Street. And out of that comes the celebrated Downing Street Memorandum. The minutes of this meeting, where Sir Richard Dearlove reports to Tony Blair on his conversations on what President Bush is thinking via George Tenet, head of the CIA. And here's the paragraph. I've memorized it. See if I can remember. It's a while ago. The president has this quote. The president has decided to go to war with Iraq. The war will be justified by the connection between Saddam Hussein weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. Translation: Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. They're likely to give them to terrorists. Last sentence of this paragraph, but the intelligence and the facts are being fixed around the policy. End quote. Now, that's the way it went down, okay? The next paragraph has Jack Straw, who was the foreign secretary at the time. But wait, there's the evidence on weapons of mass destruction is quite thin. Libya, North Korea. Others have more weapons of mass destruction than Iraq. It's going to be a hard sell. No worries, we could do it. And of course, they did. Now, some brave soul, I think it may have been the note taker, his name was Manning, okay? Now, 2 years later, decided to give that to the London Times, for God's sake. no left-wing newspaper that, okay? And the memo appeared in toto, and that's the way it read, and that's what happened before the war, okay? Now, we veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity had been saying from January of 2003 and even earlier that there was no evidence of weapons of mass destruction. This looked like a war of aggression to us. Don't do it, Mr. President. But we, of course, were not listened to either. Seldom, if ever, do intelligence analysts get the kind of rehabilitation, the kind of proof that they were right in the form of documentary evidence that this was a charade, as the British say. It was a charade. They wanted to make this war, and they would justify it by the conflation of terrorism and weapons of war, all this stuff, okay? So that was the last time these two gentlemen, and I used the, well, these two gentlemen met in secret. Now, you can bet that Bill Burns and Moore is his name, I think the head of MI6, when they met in public, that was quite different from when they met in private. Now, what did they do in public? It was really bizarre. Moore, we admire the Ukrainians. They are not only brave, they are audacious. And going into Kursk like that changed the narrative. The narrative. Okay, and Bill Burns says pretty much the same thing, okay? Well, is that what they're about? The narrative? Is that what Bill Burns' nominal chief, Avril Haines, was doing? Changing the narrative that the Russians are running out of ammunition? Or what Bill Burns told the president, say, in July of last year, that the Russians have lost already? Is the narrative what's important, apparently, to these guys? In public, it is. Now, what did they say behind the scenes? Behind the scenes, they had serious work to do. We're losing in Ukraine. When some of us, at least, encouraged those Ukrainians to go into Kursk, that turned out not to be such a good idea. Others told us that beforehand, but yeah, it was sort of a Hail Mary pass, last chance to change the narrative. Oh, it changed the narrative. Did it change the facts on the ground? Well, yes, but not the way we wanted, because they took their best troops from the front line there in the Donbass, sent them into Kursk, where they're all going to be killed now, and the front line in the Donbass is moving steadily, actually, by all accounts, at least twice as fast toward the Dnieper as it was before they lost their reinforcements, okay? They have no reinforcements. So what are they planning? Well, there has to be some sort of deus ex machina here. There has to be some sort of thing they can plug out of the blue. There's something in the nature of the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline, for instance. But they have 2 months almost to do this. Let's see what we could do together. And I fear very much a false flag of some kind, which would be blamed on the Russians, justify a lethal, very lethal, response on the part of Biden and Kamala Harris. And then the U.S. will be at war during this election. Most Americans have been misled into thinking the Russians are devils from hell and that Putin is worse than Hitler. And, you know, I do a big sigh because we've tried to educate our fellow Americans, but we have no real access to the press. And in Britain, it's just as bad, if not worse. People don't get much say in this. And we're talking about major war or major pretexts for war. So that's what worries me, not that Putin's going to authorize some limited nuclear strikes. I find that incredibly unlikely. A false flag of some kind done by British or US intelligence, well, there are all kinds of capabilities and billions of dollars spent on them every year. And if Tony Blinken or Jake Sullivan says, can you do this? Can you, CIA, do this? The answer is always a knee-jerk, of course we can. We have to justify our budget, among other things, but sure, blow up a pipeline, of course we can. There's no other answer, okay? We get the money to do it, We can summon the expertise. We can co-op people in the Navy. We can do it. So what will they be asked to do now? I don't know, but it's more than just the two of them appearing together. It's what they might do in secret. Witness the fact that in 2002, they secretly assured each other that they would gin up intelligence. And this is all important here. This is the final sentence of that little paragraph. Quote, the intelligence and facts will be shaped around the policy. In other words, we know what the policy is, war. Fixed was the word that shaped. Fixed. Okay, the intelligence and facts will be fixed, are being fixed around the policy. So that's why we have no more intelligence that anyone can rely on, at least that the stuff that's made available. That's why there's a premium on my colleagues and me, if we could say that, because we've been around, we've seen this kind of thing before, and we feel a little bit frustrated that very few get to hear us, but that doesn't mean we don't keep trying, and we are keeping trying, and we'll probably do another VIPS memo in another week or so to set things straight.
We had a presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. And in this debate, Ray, they were talking about two issues in Ukraine and in the Middle East. It seems to me that there are rumors out there, they're talking about if Kamala Harris wins, Jake Sullivan going to be her Secretary of State. And if that would be the case for the Democratic Party, it doesn't seem that they're considering any sort of change in their policy in Ukraine or in Gaza. What's your take?
Well, I think that's right. I really hadn't seen the rumors. Maybe I have a block, not reading such things. But if Kamala and her people don't see what a disaster Jacob Sullivan and Tony Blinken have been to our standing in the world, well, then they're not as not even as smart as she appeared to be during that debate. Let me make a comment on the debate that really hasn't been fleshed out at all. Do you remember when she said, and you know Putin's not going to stop in Ukraine? Poland is next. And I think the 800,000 people of Polish extraction in Pennsylvania wouldn't like that. Now, what am I getting at? This goes back to the original sin, if I may, okay? The original sin where Bill Clinton was running against Bob Dole. Bob Dole was from Kansas, but he had a lot of support in the Midwest during these key battleground states, so Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan. Okay, so Bill Clinton goes to his advisors and says, how can we win some, how can we make sure we don't lose those key states? And they say, well, you know, Poland and Hungary and the Czech and the Slovaks, they're all asking us to let them into NATO. And, you know, we promised not to do that. You know, George H.W. Bush's Secretary of State, James Baker, promised Gorbachev and Shevardnadze not one inch to the east would NATO go if you accept a reunited Germany. Just as an aside, Nima, when I heard that they were talking about a reunited Germany, maybe I saw too many World War II films, but I know a little bit about history. Okay, so this may not be a good idea. The Russians accepted it for the promise, not one inch east. Okay, so Clinton says, "What do you mean? I don't work. Show me the piece of paper on that. I'm a lawyer." Oh, there's no document. It was a gentleman's promise. But we, you know, that all kind of certification, this was done in State Department notes or in German. And the German chancellor was there the next day. And so, yeah, they all promised this. Well, promises, schmamises. Let's do it. I mean, it looks like we can make real headway there with the Polish Americans and with the Czechs and with the Slovaks and even with the Ukrainians. You know, let's do it. And so that's where the expansion of NATO began. It had no strategic value. Jack Matlock, who's the best on Soviet Union and on Russia, having been ambassador there for a long time, and whom I know quite well and trust, he says that he testified before the appropriate congressional committees that this would be crazy to expand NATO. Even George Kennan said this would start another Cold War, and God knows where we'd end up. And after his testimony, the staffers for this committee came to him and said, Ambassador Matlock, we agree with you. We know that you're absolutely right, but it's already been decided this has to do with politics, okay, not with strategy or international. And we're strong enough, and the Russians aren't, to do this, okay? Besides, it's not written down, and lawyers need it written down. So anyhow, that's what happened in 1996. And here is Kamala Harris saying, oh, you know, this is not going to, he's not going to, Putin, the devil incarnate, is not going to stop in Ukraine. He's going to, how about Poland? And this next, and, you know, she didn't say this, but the next people say, well, the Baltics, and before you know it, they'll be on the English Channel. That's what the British call a bollocks. Okay, that's a nice way of saying BS, you know. Now, why do I say that's BS? I say it's BS because the Ukrainians have said it's BS. And because last week, none other than Victoria Nuland, who is Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs and orchestrated the coup in Kyiv in February of 2014, she admitted that when the Russians and the Ukrainians came together with blessing from Putin and from Zelensky, they had the best people work out this agreement called the Istanbul Accords, because they were done in Istanbul. Erdogan was there to supervise. Former Israeli Prime Minister Bennett was in on it. All kinds of people were in on this thing. It was done. It was initialed. We have the text, okay?
What happened?
Yeah.
Let me play the clip that in which Victoria Nuland is addressing the same.
Okay.
Yeah, let me play it.
Now, let me just tell your okay. viewers, I'm not going to give you an adjective to describe her initial facial expression. I won't ruin it for you. I'll give you one after the clip.
I was told by former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett that both sides were really close to the end, to the successful end of the negotiations, and then Prime Minister Boris Johnson interfered and stopped prevented Ukrainians from signing the deal. And then Ukrainian representative Arahami kind of confirmed it, that yes, he said in an interview that there was some kind of advice from Boris Johnson to stop negotiating and to win this war militarily. Where is the myth? Where is the truth?
Relatively late in the game, the Ukrainians began asking for advice on where this thing was going. And it became clear to us, clear to the Brits, clear to others, that Putin's main condition was buried in an annex to this document that they were working on. And it included limits on the precise kinds of weapon systems that Ukraine could have after the deal, such that Ukraine would basically be neutered as a military force. And there were no similar constraints on Russia. Russia wasn't required to pull back. Russia wasn't required to have a buffer zone from the Ukrainian border, wasn't required to have the same constraints on its military facing Ukraine. And so people inside Ukraine and people outside Ukraine started asking questions about whether this was a good deal. And it was at that point that it fell apart.
Yeah.
Would the smirk be too unkind? I don't think so. Look what she's saying. She's saying, yeah, the deal was done, but it would have neutered Ukraine. Well, yeah. I mean, that's the whole idea. Oh, Ukraine would go back to being neutral again, right? Neutered, neutral. Were there provisions whereby Ukraine would not be able to build up HIMARS and attack them? Of course there were. It was an inch and a half thick, this thing. Okay, there were provisions, and there were provisions preventing the Russians from doing the similar things right on the border. She's lying about that. Okay, so you know. The biggest lie is that the things that the Russians really want, had she put it, the main condition that the Russians had was neutering the Ukrainian military. That wasn't the main condition. The main condition was that Ukraine had to give up any attempt to become a member of NATO, and they did. Part of the agreement. It was initials. And this fellow, Arakhamiya, was the main negotiator for the Ukrainians, and he's chief of Zelensky's fraction in the Ukrainian Rada, their parliament, and he's best friends with Zelensky. So he was a trusted person, and he was given the go-ahead to do this, and was the Americans. Oh, they asked people inside and outside. You go, oh, what are those outside, right? So Boris Johnson comes in, and Arakhamiya says this. We had all set to go, and all of a sudden, Johnson comes in, and he says, no, this is a quote from Arakhamiya quoting Johnson, let's just keep fighting, period, end quote. Why? Does Johnson or does the U.S. care about Ukraine? If they did, the fighting stopped. This was a ceasefire agreement. This was an agreement where neutrality would prevail and Ukraine could prosper. No, it wasn't about that. It was about having the ability to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. And we have none other than our Secretary of Defense, Austin, saying precisely that was the aim, okay? So if they thought they could do this using a proxy like Ukraine with a fraction of the population, a fraction of the arms, a fraction of the productive capability that Russia has, well, as I've said before in your program, Obama himself was very explicit about warning against giving the Ukrainians any idea that they could possibly prevail against a much stronger Russia. Those were his words, okay? And what I usually added, I will add again, and there was a deputy secretary of state at the time. And he said, oh, President Obama is completely right, because any arms that we give to Ukraine could be matched and doubled and tripled and quadrupled by the Russians. Who said that? Well, he was deputy secretary of state. What's his name? Anthony Blinken. So, parse that, folks. He comes into office with his mentor, Joe Biden, and for some reason he changes his mind because Joe Biden says, no, we can do this. We're America. We're exceptional. We can do whatever we want. And so let's go ahead and do that. Give the Russians a black eye because they're evil incarnate. And after all, we are the indispensable country of the world. They played to that, both Blinken and Sullivan. And we are where we are today with Ukraine falling apart. And not least, you know, if you care about human life, most estimates say that about 500,000 Ukrainian troops dead at this point. I don't know how many injured. Russian troops, most people say 100,000, 150,000. That too, you know, these people are dead. Why? Because Victoria Nuland, wipe that smirk off your face, Toria, thought that she could have a victory. After all, her name is Victoria, right? She could have a victory against a much stronger Russia. And It boggles the mind that people like Tony Blinken disregarded what Obama said and decided, well, yeah, maybe we should try this because after all, nothing will happen to us. We are the exceptional country in the world.
I wanted to talk about 9/11 since, but I have another talk, Ray, and I have to run. Thank you so much to be with us today. Great pleasure.
You're most welcome.
As always, Ray.
Thank you, Nima.